And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. Who's Talking, featuring interesting guests from our community on News Talk 1360 WCATL. Now, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Chapel Hill's Billy Barnes is one of America's really most widely published photographers. Those who know his photography understand why. His book, his photography, illustrates a brand new book called To Right These Wrongs, which is a history of the North Carolina Fund, which was a big part of the late 1960s in North Carolina and in America. So I persuaded Billy Barnes to come visit with us to talk about his work and about the history and work of the North Carolina Fund. And Billy Barnes, welcome.
Nice to be here.
It's sure nice to have you. You know, we know you as a photographer. I know you maybe, well, I know you in several ways. One is I have loved over the time that I've been living in North Carolina or been living in this area, the pieces that you've done for UNCTV, just about North Carolina. You've taken me different places and told personal stories. Others in Chapel Hill know you because of your photography. I know that my friend Bob Anthony is so grateful, and the people at the Wilson Library are so grateful for the contribution of your, I say thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of photographs about North Carolina that will be available now forever for North Carolina research.
I got an email yesterday that indicated to me they have 63,000 of my photographs at Wilson Library in the North Carolina collection. I was amazed. I've thought of it in terms of 35 or 40.
Well, the difference between 35 or 40, it would take us years to go through those and catalog them and get them in order, scan them, and make them available digitally for people to look at.
There's a young man over there who says on his blog about my photography collection that he has seen every one of those photographs. Either by looking at the negatives or looking at the proof sheets or whatever, he claims, and I believe him. He's a wonderful guy. He claims he has seen every single one of those 64,000 photographs.
I think we got to get him on this program, hook him up to a lie detector. And yeah. But I know the wonderful man that you're talking about, and he is not anybody but someone who tells the truth. And so I kind of believe that. 65,000 about – is that right?
63? I think it was 63.
63,000 photographs. Now, part of – some of those photographs are the same ones that I saw in the new book, To Right These Wrongs, about the North Carolina Fund. And you were not only the photographer. I mean, that was a large part of your work and a – important part of your permanent legacy, but you didn't sign on just to be a photographer, did you? Or was that where it got – how did your adventure with the North Carolina Fund get started, and what was the North Carolina Fund?
I was in Atlanta. I was chief of the Atlanta News Bureau for McGraw-Hill Magazines. At the time, McGraw-Hill had they were the second largest publisher in the world at the time, and they had 41 magazines. All of them were related to business, starting with the biggie Bible of the business world, Business Week, and going down to such more narrow considerations as Coal Age, a trucking magazine, and two of my favorites were heavy construction magazines because I like the outdoors and I had a ball working for them. And my function was to feed stories back to New York about what was going on.
You were a writer, a photographer, or both?
I was hired at McGraw-Hill as a writer. But one day I had an assignment over in New Jersey. I worked in Manhattan, 42nd Street. Had an assignment over in New Jersey, and it was a very simple assignment having to do with a store that sells appliances. And I said – I knew that the magazine owned a Rolleiflex camera. And I said, look, instead of hiring a photographer for a couple hundred dollars a day, give me the camera and two rolls of film, and I'll try shooting the pictures for this story. And they said, well, it sounds like a deal to us. So they gave me the camera, I shot the story, and they ran the pictures. And that kind of started—
Ran your pictures for the first try.
Right.
And you saved them $200.
That's right. And that was my beginnings with McGraw-Hill as a writer and photographer. Well, when I wangled, we didn't get along too well in New York. It was kind of like being in a very foreign land, and we didn't. After a year, we decided.
Now, who's we?
My wife and I, Ann Barnes and I.
The you're not married to the famous Ann Barnes.
Yeah, I am married.
Well,
to
that's the, another story. But we wanted. I want to remember that the maybe the main way I know you is through your marriage to the former distinguished representative Ann Barnes. But well, that's another story. But you didn't like New York, so you moved to
I turned in my resignation, and they finally decided that rather than lose me and the money they'd spent in orienting me to their way of business, they would give me a chance at a job in Atlanta as the head of their tiny little news bureau down there. And so that's the way I ended up in Atlanta, covering eight states for these 41 magazines. And so I had been there a little less than 5 years, and about midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning in December of 63, I got a call. Well, the phone rang, and Ann went to the phone, and it was John Ely, the novelist, well-known North Carolina novelist who lives in Winston-Salem now. And I had John in college. He taught me a course in television writing, and we had kind of stayed in touch through the years. And it was John on the phone. John was kindly of a night owl. And he said to Ann, I'm working for the governor now, and Governor Sanford, and we've got a program going for a statewide approach to problems of poverty. And we're calling our people in, and we would like you to come up and interview for the job of public relations director for this nonprofit foundation that's going to be dealing with problems of poverty. And Ann said, well, gosh, it's the middle of the night. Can he call you in the morning? He said, well, I want to talk to him now. So I stumbled.
What time of day was or what time of night
it
was
this? It was somewhere around midnight. Uh-huh. So I stumbled to the phone. Well, bottom line is I had an assignment, happened to have an assignment in eastern North Carolina having to do with some mining that was going on over there. And I said, John, I'm going to be in North Carolina in about a week and a half, and I'll come and talk to you. Well, I came and talked with him. I ended up talking with George Esser, the executive director of the North Carolina Fund, and with Pete McKnight, who was at the time the publisher of the Charlotte Observer, and he was the president of the board of the North Carolina Fund. And I was hired.
So and, you're right there on that trip.
Right. No. Well, no. Actually, I think a day went by, and George Esser and Pete Knight conferred, McKnight conferred, and I was hired within about a week of then, mm-hmm. or I was offered the job. And I told him I'd talk it over with Ann and see what we could do. And I had read a book, I wish I could remember the author's name, about American men and how many of them at about age 30 get to wondering whether they're in the right kind of job and whether they're just making money or whether they're doing something to improve the lot of humankind in the world. And I actually had been thinking for some months, I love this job. The money is not bad. The subdivision we live in is not bad, but I'm wondering whether I ought to be doing something a little more philanthropic. And so this came along at a most vulnerable time, so I left a doggone good job to come back to North Carolina and work for this private foundation. I've often said the North Carolina Fund was populated not entirely, but to a great extent by people who were a little bit nuts. And the reason, including me, the reason for that is we knew going in that the North Carolina Fund was only going to exist for 5 years. And that ain't exactly the way to build a career. And so we did have, especially I had on the staff I acquired as time went on, a bunch of very young people who were a little bit nuts, but very creative, and people who were willing to spend 5 years at a job that they knew they'd be fired from in 1969. So that's the long version of
the
story.
We're visiting with Billy Barnes, and we're talking about his career with the North Carolina Fund, and we'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Billy Barnes, Chapel Hill's own Billy Barnes, known to many of you as by reason of his fantastic photography collection at now housed in part in the Wilson Library. I guess, Billy, it's when I talk about the availability of your photographs in the Wilson Library collection, it's also important to say that those thousands, tens of thousands of photographs are also available commercially for use by people who find the fantastic collection of illustrations useful for textbooks or for the illustration of other books or projects or anything else. So you're still in the photography. You're still in the photography business.
Yeah, I still do an occasional assignment. I don't take just anything that comes along. I'm at a time of life when I feel that my work ought to be. My work's never been boring. I've had about a 2% boring percentage in my career, but I'm grateful to be in position to pick and choose some, but I still get a juicy a magazine assignment now and then, either photography or writing or both. And I am in touch with a lot of publishers myself, but mostly my work is sold by agents. I have four or five agents, and one in particular in California that do a wonderful job for me. And for an aging photographer, there's nothing quite like getting that check or getting that notation in your bank balance. That an unexpected check came in. It's kind of like finding $10 on the street that you don't know who it belongs to. That's right.
Billy, turning back to the North Carolina Fund, you told us the great story about how you were enticed back to North Carolina to work for what kind of, in the 1960s, seemed to be sort of a strange animal. And what was the North Carolina Fund and what did you do for it?
Well, let me tell you why there was the North Carolina Fund. Terry Sanford and John Ely and who is his one of his many several idea men decided that North Carolina had to do something about poverty. Poverty was rampant among whites and blacks at the time. And he realized that at that time the governor could only serve 4 years. Terry realized that one of these years had already gone by. No, two of these years had already gone by. And if he didn't hurry up, it wasn't going to happen. And he also knew that getting this sort of thing through the legislature would take a lot of time. So he decided to try to get private foundation support for the effort, which meant that he wouldn't be answerable to the North Carolina legislature. He could go on and do his thing with private money, and they wouldn't have much say about it. So he went to the Ford Foundation, and being the salesman that he always was, he went to Henry Heald, the president of the Ford Foundation, and said, we didn't come up. He went up there with John Ely. He said, "We didn't come up here to ask you for money. We came up here to ask you for your ideas." Well, the guys at the Ford Foundation said later, no one had ever come up there and said, we're not looking for your money. We were looking for your ideas. They were so enchanted. Terry brought them down here for a 2-day airplane tour of several parts of North Carolina. And Heald was so enchanted that before he left, he promised $7 million, which was a lot of money in 19.
Well, it still is a lot of money. I guess, you know, as you're taking us back in time, a lot of things are different in 2010 than they were in 1962 and 1963 and 64 when all of this was beginning to generate. One of them was that we hadn't had any kind of really war on poverty. I mean, this was before the Lyndon Johnson war on poverty. This was before government had been thinking about tackling it in any other way other than just having good social services programs and aid to the poor and things like that. There was no sort of war on poverty. So this was it even sounds a little radical today, but it was really radical thinking for a governor in those days. Or did you all perceive it that way?
I wasn't sophisticated enough to perceive it that way, but I'm sure George Esser did. I certainly perceived the problem, but I guess I didn't realize two things. I didn't realize how risky it was going to be because of the racial situation, and I really I thought of it as a constant problem, and I didn't think of it as any kind of risk, really.
I interrupted you when you were sort of telling me about the history of the Ford Foundation grant, and then what happened next?
Well, Terry also was able to get from the Winston-Salem Tobacco Foundations, the two foundations, grants in the amount of $2.5 million. So what he had is $9.5 million of non-tax money, and the original idea was to have a small staff, maybe a max of 8 or 9 people, in a small office in Durham, who would ask for ideas from communities all over North Carolina for how they would go about approaching their problems of poverty if they got a grant from the North Carolina Fund. So we would actually, the original intent was for us to sit back there in Durham and kind of manage all of this.
And to get community groups to present ideas for attacking poverty, and you all would judge the merits and the effectiveness and then give them the money, and it would be just like a regular foundation in many respects.
That's right.
How did it turn out to be different from that?
Well, one of the major thrusts was we wanted local agencies like public assistance and health and housing to to stop fighting turf wars and get together and make a proposal to the North Carolina Fund for what they would do with this money to benefit low-income people. A second emphasis was to get low-income people involved so that you weren't talking down to them and having multimillionaires sit on the board and decide what they needed, but to ask to actually organize poor folks and put them on the necessary boards to involve them in policymaking.
Well, that worked out to be later on as that worked its way through, and the question of to what degree poor people were going to participate in the management or manage themselves the various programs got to be one of the interesting parts of the history as is described in the new book, To Right These Wrongs. And I'd like to take a break from talking to Billy Barnes. We'll come back and talk about some of the things that happened as the fund, North Carolina Fund, started operation. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Billy Barnes, our own Chapel Hill's Billy Barnes, who is noted as a part of a brand new book called To Right These Wrongs, which is about the North Carolina Fund and the battle to end poverty and inequality in 1960s America. The book is written by Robert Korstad from Duke and Jim Lulitis from UNC. Photography by Billy Barnes. And Billy Barnes is, a major character in the book, along with the late George Esser, who's also one of our neighbors. And Billy Barnes, many other characters in the book who've gone on to other important positions in North Carolina life. When we stopped talking before the break, you pointed out that one of the original objectives, I guess, of the North Carolina Fund was to bring groups who are already providing resources for poor people together to do it more effectively, and also to bring the voice of poor, the people who are being served, into the picture to be sure that they were heard. All that sounds great, but it got to be a challenge to manage the asking people to give up the power that they had over the resources and give them to poor people who, in their view, didn't know anything about managing money. You were in the middle of all of this. When did you and you were in charge as public relations director or the director of public relations. You're responsible for sort of helping to keep the peace and explaining it to everybody. How did this problem of power manifest itself?
Well, let me go back a minute and talk about some of the factors that fed into this from the federal level. Many times during history, something seemingly unrelated has a great effect on something. A has a great effect on B, an unexpected one, perhaps. One of the things that happened while the North Carolina Fund was in the planning stage was there was an assassination in Dallas of the president. And suddenly we had a new president. And the new president, after giving it some thought, decided a few months later that his emphasis was going to be a social one, and his big thing was going to be a war on poverty. And at the time that Lyndon started his push for a war on poverty at the federal level, the North Carolina Fund had been in business for about 3 months. And when the Economic Opportunity Act was passed, Suddenly, we started getting in Durham at the North Carolina Fund Office phone calls from the Labor Department, from the Education Department, from the Housing Department, wanting to know, could they send us some money for pilot programs to get the war on poverty cranked up? And it was amazing. We had this little quiet foundation that had a suite of offices. I think there were four rooms upstairs on Perry Street in Durham. And here, these people are offering us literally millions of dollars. One of the things that they wanted us to do was to train the first class of people who were volunteers for a program called VISTA, which we did at Camp New Hope out here north of Chapel Hill. But we had practically no experience in rural poverty, only 3 months. But we were 3 months ahead of everybody else in the country because the emphasis of the Ford Foundation and HUD and so forth at the federal level had been on urban poverty. And nobody had really addressed problems of rural poverty since the days of the 1930s. So suddenly, the North Carolina Fund started growing and growing and growing because our board and George Esser and Terry Sanford agreed that if there was going to be a war on poverty, North Carolina needed to get as big a piece of the pie as possible. So the North Carolina Fund was the instrument that brought a lot more of the early war on poverty money to North Carolina than most states, even some of the bigger, much bigger states. So one of the things, and to get back to your question about problems that arose trying to give poor people some power, was the fact that the Lyndon Johnson thrust, the Office of Economic Opportunity thrust on the national level. I don't know. I'm not going to pretend that they learned it from us, but they had a huge emphasis on involvement of the poor, not just non-poor people, professionals, and moneyed people deciding what the poor needed, but to find out from the poor what they needed and get them involved in planning of the remedies. So this was a fine partnership that we had with the federal government. Toward the mid-60s, I think probably what you're referring to, the whole notion of black power arose. And as more and more black people, and in the mountains, poor people, white people, started wanting a piece of the power pie, this caused a whole lot of problems because racial problems were, we had racial problems in North Carolina just like they had everywhere else that there's any significant amount of black people.
Let me interrupt you just a little bit. One of the great stories in the new book, To Right These Wrongs, and you were right in the middle of it, was what happened in Durham. Now, this is an urban situation, and a great story about how things got started, about trying to find out what poor people needed and then trying to help get them organized. And then all of a sudden, from the standpoint of the established white power structure in Durham, everything seemed to be going crazy with the poor people and the black power structure being funded by the North Carolina Fund, seemingly to stand up and challenge the existing power structure. And that was the problem, at least as far as trying to work out an accommodation and maintain the support of the white power structure in Durham. I mean, and that must have been a terrific challenge for you as the public affairs director.
Well, it was a challenge to try to explain what involvement of the poor is all about, because it was a foreign notion to most people who were in power especially at the municipal level in North Carolina. Durham was a natural place for a lot of this work to be done in terms of involvement of the poor, because there, as everyone knows, there is and was an element of black wealth already in Durham, with the largest black-owned insurance company in the world, and banks and so forth being owned by black people, which certainly was not true in Rocky Mount and Greensboro. So there was promising ground there for involvement of the poor, but there were some complicating things happened, especially the assassination of Martin Luther King, which resulted in the burning of vast areas of, I think it was 20, 25 United States cities. And there were some valiant efforts put forth by people who were already involved in the anti-poverty effort at the local level in Durham to allow people to manifest their grief and at the same time not go to breaking out windows and looting stores and burning places down. So there was a wonderful young man named Howard Fuller who was already on the payroll of Operation Breakthrough, which was Durham's local poverty effort, an agency that received funds from the federal government directly and from the North Carolina Fund. He had done a masterful job of creating neighborhood organizations, going around knocking on doors, saying, "What do you need? Maybe we can help."
Billy, excuse me for interrupting you, but in the book, To Right These Wrongs, the role of Howard Fuller is a very important part of the story. And I just say that his community organizing work reminded me of another African-American who did that kind of work, who now is our president, that it was just the hard nose getting around, finding out what people wanted and building trust. And just to shortcut this story because we're running out of time, but Howard Fuller turned out to be a hero in many respects, because in Durham there wasn't any burning buildings. He worked hard he was able, based on his leadership ability and the trust that he built, to channel the disappointment and the grief into nonviolent demonstrations rather than burning demonstrations. For that, looking back on it, he has to be a hero. But according to the story, some of the white power structure were not appreciative. They thought he had, he was organizing the demonstrations and stirring things up. So there were different perceptions of this person whom you perceive, and I kind of perceive from reading the story, as being a hero.
Yes, there were. There was great outcry about Howard using the words black power. This scared the heck out of a lot of people. And especially when these other cities started burning and there were pictures all over television of the National Guard marching into cities here and there, including a couple in North Carolina. And there was a lot of fear, and at that time we had a congressman named Jim Gardner, who later became lieutenant governor, or maybe yep. He was lieutenant governor first.
No, he came later on.
Yeah.
And I tell you, we need to take a break. Okay. I mean, there's so many stories in here. I'm just really disappointed. But there's one story that I want you to tell about the mountains and your work establishing newspapers and maybe a radio station that we just got to get on before we quit. So let's take a break and come back. Visiting with Billy Barnes, we're talking about his work in the North Carolina Fund, all in the context of a brand new book called To Right These Wrongs. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Billy Barnes, and we're talking about the North Carolina Fund. It's all in the context of a brand new book published by UNC Press called To Right These Wrongs, which is a history of the North Carolina Fund. Billy Barnes photographs illustrate that book, and he was a major part of it. One of the stories told in the book, Billy Barnes, is about the work in the mountains, which was different and special in the sense there's no racial complications or not any major racial complications up there, but a whole bunch of problems about confronting the power structure. And you, this great idea emerged in the North Carolina Fund to start a poor people-oriented newspapers or group of newspapers in the mountains. Sound like a fantastic idea. You were supportive, maybe an originator of that idea. How did it work out?
Well, a friend of mine I had made at the Office of Economic Opportunity in Washington called me one day and said, we're getting a lot of proposals up here, people wanting the money we've got, but we never get anything that's creative. We want to hear from you with a creative idea. Well, I had kind of rolling around in the back of my mind for a long time a creative idea that I never had really proposed to OEO. And so I wrote a proposal, and it called for a way to give voice to poor people and to, in return, give them information about the programs that were going on that might benefit them. And I proposed that a relatively small amount of money in the great scheme of things be set aside for a radio station, one or more radio stations, that would be staffed by low-income people who had been trained to do basic radio work, and also to have a maybe weekly small newspaper or newsletter, I called it a newspaper, print the voices, things that were coming from the voices of low-income people about how they felt about their plight, or maybe how they didn't feel about their plight, how their pride was more important than their lack of indoor plumbing, whatever their opinion was, to get feedback from the low-income people, and at the same time provide information on what's available from the local anti-poverty agency in the way of help with housing, health, and so forth. You know, there are free vaccinations for the next 3 weeks at the health department or whatever.
Sounds like a reasonable idea. What happened?
Well, what happened was the newspaper called the Watauga Democrat, which wasn't that was a misnomer. They wrote an article that said that the North Carolina Fund wanted to have a Pravda, which was, of course, the leading communist newspaper in Russia. They wanted to create a Pravda where the people would take over the media, and the local government would be overthrown and da 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 da. And a couple of congressmen, a couple of very conservative congressmen from North Carolina, picked this up. One of them made a long, long speech on the floor of the Congress, and the North Carolina Fund started getting calls, and the Community Action Agency called WAMI in the mountains, Watauga, Avery, and Mitchell.
Yancey.
And Yancey counties. We started getting phone calls from agencies that we were working with in Washington saying, we're getting such heat from Congress that from individual congressmen and senators, we've got to come down and look at your books and make sure that you're spending this federal money the way you're supposed to.
I hate to interrupt this great story. I mean, but that's the main story, is that whatever project you got, you better be careful. It's a lesson Mike Easley learned, lesson you learned up in the mountains, is that you don't challenge the newspapers, or you don't thumb your nose at the newspapers, or you're going to get murdered because they can beat you. Billy Barnes, thanks for sharing your stories with us. Thanks.
My pleasure.
The great photographs that you contributed to the new book about the North Carolina Fund. The new book is To Right These Wrongs. It's an important part of North Carolina history. And our own Billy Barnes is not only the photographer whose work is there, but is a major character. And this story that we kind of got halfway through is not the only story about which you're an important figure. Thanks for sharing it with us. Thanks to all of y'all for listening. And this has been Who's Talking? We'll be back right here soon.